Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
From the St. Louis Public Radio Newsroom, this is The Gateway. It's Monday, September 8th. I'm Abby Larico. Missouri lawmakers will return to Jefferson City today with momentum and some pushback on redrawing the state's congressional maps and limiting voters' ability to pass laws. St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum gets us up to speed and gives us a preview as the second week of this special legislative session begins. Plus, Queen Sugar actress Tina Lifford is embracing how she solidified her legacy on the small screen for more than four decades by prioritizing her mental wellness.
I started to realize that I was experiencing a greater sense of internal well-being. I wasn't as afraid of life.
She speaks with STLPR's Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. That's all coming up on The Gateway. The man who was with Michael Brown Jr. when he was killed by a Ferguson police officer has died after he was shot Sunday morning. A spokesperson with the Ferguson Police Department confirmed Dorian Johnson died from injuries from the shooting on the 9600 block of Abaco Court. That's less than a mile from where Brown was killed. Police say one person is in custody connected to the shooting and an investigation is ongoing. Posts mourning Johnson filled social media on Sunday. He spoke last year at a memorial held on the 10th anniversary of Brown's killing. Documents reveal a link between a controversial data center project in St. Charles and Google. St. Louis Public Radio's Kate Grumke reports on what she uncovered in public records.
St. Charles City officials signed non-disclosure agreements with Spark Innovations, LLC. That company is one of at least five that are registered to a Michael Montfort, a David Thomas, or both. Those companies have been involved in early stages of Google data center projects in Kansas City, Indianapolis, and West Memphis. Last month, public outcry led the developer to pull an application for the $1 billion St. Charles data center project. Soon after, the St. Charles City Council unanimously passed a one-year moratorium on data center applications. But the project developer told city officials it would be back. I'm Kate Grumke, St. Louis Public Radio.
A plan to overhaul St. Louis's more than 50-year-old zoning code is now underway. The Zoning Upgrade, or ZOOP, plan is meant to make it easier for people to build in St. Louis. Board of Aldermen President Megan Green pushed for the process. She says the code update is essential for reversing shrinking population trends in the city.
Part of this is not just supporting the building of housing and of businesses, but it's also creating a city that welcomes more population and welcomes more density.
Green says right now, potential developers must jump through a lot of hoops in order to build. The process is expected to take up to 18 months, and a 12-member citizen advisory committee will help guide it. The historic Goodwill Complex in St. Louis's Central West End is being transformed into a hub for bioscience startup companies. STLPR's Lucretia Wembley reports.
Washington University acquired the building in 2019, and it will now be known as Catalyst, powered by WashU. It has about 163,000 square feet and will also serve as a graduation space for startups. The hub is designed to nurture bioscience companies by providing lab and office spaces and other critical support. The seven-story facility will expand by four stories in the $100 million renovation. C2N Diagnostics will be the first to occupy the complex by late 2026. The company develops diagnostic tests for Alzheimer's and other brain diseases. I'm Lucretia Wembley, St. Louis Public Radio.
Unionized Boeing employees say they aren't concerned about losing their jobs, even after the company announced they'd hire replacements for their striking workers. Boeing quality specialist Freddie Stover says the company already struggled to hire skilled workers before the strike began.
We're not worried about that they're going to try to hire 3,200 people to replace us, who's going to train them?
About 3,200 workers are entering the sixth week of striking after rejecting Boeing's contract August 3rd. They say the hiring announcement has not fazed them, and they're continuing to strike until Boeing changes its terms. A company executive told the media that he does not plan to change the economic framework of the contract, but he is open to small changes. U.S. Steel will quit shipping in slabs of steel to be processed at Granite City Works next month. That's according to a union memo shared with St. Louis Public Radio. The memo says that the company has stated there will be no layoffs because of this decision. With both blast furnaces shut down, steelworkers in Granite City had just been processing slabs from other U.S. steel facilities in the last couple years. It's not clear what work will remain. This news comes as many in the Metro East wonder if the mill will survive after President Donald Trump approved the $14 billion purchase of U.S. steel by the Japanese company Nippon. A South Central Illinois farmer donated 40,000 pounds of watermelons, sweet corn, and pumpkins to military families at Scott Air Force Base. It's all part of a new program from the federal government aimed at cutting down on wasted food. STLPR's Will Bauer reports.
The new program piloted at the Metro East base is called Feed It Onward. Run by the Environmental Protection Agency, it coordinates with farmers that have unwanted food, who then give that away to military families. Farmer Sarah Fry says she donated up to $24,000 worth of produce that large retail grocery stores wouldn't take.
And we need to sort of reset our minds, too, as Americans, that we don't want everything to look perfect in our grocery stores. We want to be able to purchase visually imperfect fruit, because oftentimes that's the best fruit.
Fry and EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin say they're hopeful other farmers can replicate this partnership at other military installations. At Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Earlier this year, the U.S. Department of Agriculture cut two programs that connected local farmers and ranchers to schools and food banks as part of cost-cutting efforts. When asked why the administration wanted to start this program and cancel the others, Zeldin declined to answer. The Missouri General Assembly reconvenes today to weigh two proposals with enormous political implications. One, fulfilling a request from President Trump, would significantly change the congressional voting districts around Kansas City and St. Louis and likely lead to the loss of a safe Democratic House seat. The other would dramatically increase the threshold for citizen initiatives to change state law or amend the Constitution. Brian Ellison of partner station KCUR spoke with St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum about the bills and what to expect this week in Jefferson City.
Jason, you've covered a lot of sessions in Jefferson City. How does the atmosphere of this one compare with the others?
It's very tense. And I've been in Jefferson City for a long time and have seen a lot of very heated debates over a lot of things. I don't want to say this is the most tense I've ever seen it, but when you have people calling the map racist, and they're arguing that taking away most of the initiative petition process is part of an end of democracy. This is the type of thing that you don't typically see every day, even in a very rambunctious Missouri General Assembly.
Well, let's start with redistricting. A House committee voted 10-4 to approve the map that was proposed by Governor Kehoe. What happened at that hearing and at the Rules Committee meeting on Friday?
So the vast majority of testimony on Thursday was negative. There was only one person that testified in favor of this new map, and that was Susan Klein of Missouri Right to Life. Every other person that was there really doesn't like it. And as a reminder, the main part of this map is converting Democratic Congressman Emanuel Cleaver's 5th District, which takes in most of Kansas City, into a much more Republican seat by connecting it with a lot of rural counties east of Kansas City. So they don't like that. The St. Louis changes, while they are not as drastic, are significant. St. Charles County being in its own county means the creatively drawn 3rd District that looks like Pac-Man now kind of makes more logical sense. And because St. Charles County is all in one district now, part of that was in Congresswoman Ann Wagner's 2nd District, and she's going to be adding parts of Jefferson County, Washington County, Gasconade County, and Crawford County. It doesn't really change the Wagner's district that much in terms of its competitiveness. It's a Republican-leaning seat. She was always going to be slightly favored for re-election, but this may make it a little bit easier, but it could still be a very competitive seat.
And of course, there are changes over on the Kansas City side to other districts as well. The 6th District, currently represented by Sam Graves, loses a number of Republican voters up in Northeast Missouri and gains some Democratic voters in Clay County. The 4th District, represented by Mark Alford, also gains much of downtown Kansas City, the Plaza, the Brookside, more affluent areas of the city and very Democratic leaning, but also keeps Fort Leonard Wood and Whiteman Air Force Base. Big changes all over the state. I guess I'm wondering what arguments Democrats are going to be making from what you've seen so far, and will they have any impact?
No, they will not have any impact on whether the map passes. This map is going to pass the House. I think that, yes, the Senate Democrats could filibuster this, but I think their filibuster will be shot down by a filibuster squashing motion called the previous question. What they're going to argue is that this map is illegal, that the Missouri Constitution doesn't authorize mid-decade redistricting. They're going to point out that it uses outdated census data from 2020 instead of 2024, 2025. So they can't say for sure whether the districts are of equal population. And one of the things that was really interesting from Representative Lakeisha Bosley of St. Louis is because the census data is not updated, we don't know if the first district, which will remain the only Democratic seat if this map passes, is a minority-majority district, which is really important because that district is protected by the Voting Rights Act, and that could be a really obvious way to challenge this entire map.
Of course, Jason, this special session has two issues to consider. The other is reform of how statewide ballot measures that are initiated by citizen petitions are handled. What's the gist of the proposal that has now made it out of the committee, also along party lines?
This is probably one of the most far-reaching restrictions on the initiative petition process that I've ever seen, and I've covered a lot of different iterations of this. It would require any constitutional amendment or any statutory ballot item that gets put on the ballot through the initiative petition process, you would need to get it not only passed by a statewide vote, but 8 out of 8 congressional districts.
Right, which is kind of, well, basically impossible on anything but the most non-controversial, the most unanimous kind of thing.
Now, interestingly, this does not apply to amendments or ballot items that change statute that are put on the ballot by the legislature. So there would be two completely different standards that voters would decide here. One tangible example of that, if this had been in effect last year in 2024, the Amendment 3, which legalized abortion and put abortion rights protections in the constitutions, would have needed a affirmative statewide vote and passage in 8 out of 8 congressional districts. The new Amendment 3 that's going to be before voters in 2026 to repeal much of that abortion rights amendment protections will only need a majority vote.
As few as 5% or so of Missouri voters opposing a measure could keep it from passing under this new threshold.
That's right, because there is an entirely plausible scenario where a measure passes by 70% in 7 out of 8 congressional districts, but then fails by one vote in one of them, and it would not be enacted. I think that this is not as sure of a thing to pass as the redistricting map.
So quickly, Jason, remind us what's next this week. When does the General Assembly come back into session? What should we expect in terms of voting?
On Monday, the House will take up these bills and likely perfect them, which means they'll pass for the first time. Tuesday, they'll pass it a second time and send those measures to the Senate. The Senate is expected to hear them in committee, likely on Thursday. And Friday will be the likely conclusion of this special session, where if senators decide to use the previous question motion, they'll pass a new map and send a very restrictive package to the initiative petition process to voters in 2026.
That was St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum speaking with Brian Ellison. Look for continued coverage of this special session at stlpr.org and on air and in the podcast throughout the week. actress Tina Lifford has made a name for herself on the small screen in cultural hits such as Queen Sugar, South Central, and the Temptations miniseries. The Illinois native credits her longevity toward prioritizing her mental wellness. STLPR's Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson spoke with Lifford ahead of her appearance this week at the Own Your Now Wellness Experience in St. Louis about her career, mental health, and how she became an actress.
I knew that I wanted to be an actress when I was in the second grade. So every time I was in a drama class, I excelled and I felt like I was in my happy place.
So you're widely known for playing Aunt Vi in Owen's Queen Sugar, but you were also in the legendary Temptations miniseries.
All these years later, and I'm talking decades, right? People still stop me on the street and talk to me about Mama Hayes. And I think that that miniseries is one of the most successful miniseries on record.
You've been in the entertainment industry for more than 40 years, but mental wellness has always been intricately woven throughout your career. Why?
For me, I wanted to be an actress in the second grade. And then in the fifth grade, I had a trauma on stage where I froze so completely that after I don't know how many minutes, my teacher finally had to come to center stage, pick me up, and carry me off. And I didn't realize that experience bored itself inside of me. But, you know, when I was in the process of creating my career, you know, decades later, it got triggered in an audition. And then it required me delving deep into myself to understand my reactions when it came to auditions. And that work introduced me to myself in very meaningful, profound, and enlightening ways.
You've also been working to help other people realize that for themselves. What exactly is the Inner Fitness Project?
As I spent more quality time with myself, meaning time where I was being curious about my thoughts, my feelings, and beliefs, as opposed to like running from myself, I started to realize that I was experiencing a greater sense of internal well-being. I wasn't as afraid of life and feeling like something or someone would need to save me like I felt on that stage. And the more that freedom started happening inside of me, I knew that this information could be as universal and well understood and practiced for our internal fitness, the way we exercise and take care of our bodies with physical fitness.
You will be headlining Own Your Now's Wellness Experience. What can people expect?
I am expecting to have a good time and to have a lot of chuckles and fun, and at the same time be offering a space that elevates and feels good, and that you can walk away from that space with a little bit more of yourself.
That was actress and Inner Fitness Project CEO Tina Lifford speaking with St. Louis Public Radio's Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Our Jonathan All edited that piece. The Gateway is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, a listener-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Music by Ryan McNeely of Adult Fur. I'm Abby Larico, and from the St. Louis Public Radio newsroom, thanks for listening to The Gateway.